Support for Valley Edition comes from the James Irvine Foundation, the California Endowment. Health happens when California values schools more than prisons. Learn more at calendow.org. And the California Healthcare Foundation, rating hospitals, doctors, and long-term care. Smarter choices start at calqualitycare.org.
From Valley Public Radio in Fresno and Bakersfield, this is Valley Edition, FM89's weekly news magazine program. I'm Joe Moore. On today's show, has the California dream turned into a nightmare? A new column in the New York Times suggests that it has. But are the Golden State's best days truly behind it, or is the state simply reinventing itself for a new generation? We'll discuss it with author Daniel Duane. We'll also learn why StoryCorps is working with a local nonprofit group to document and preserve the stories of Valley residents who are in hospice care, and November is Hospice Awareness Month. We'll also get a preview of an event that brings local audiences a sustainable look at the world of fashion. It's the return of Trash Chic at the Fresno Art Museum coming this weekend. That's all on today's show later this hour. Right now, though, we turn our attention to the Sierra. You may have noticed, if you've been up in the mountains lately, a change in color in the Central Sierra. And I'm not talking about the recent snow that dusted some mountain peaks after yesterday's rain and snowstorms. Rather, I'm talking about the change in the color of the forest. The bark beetle has killed so many trees in the Sierra Nevada that officials are now worried people visiting places like the Sierra National Forest are in danger just by being there. Last week, Governor Jerry Brown declared a state of emergency when it comes to the dead trees, and he's asking for federal help to remove them safely. FM89's Ezra David Romero reports from Bass Lake on what the Forest Service is doing to protect visitors.
The area around Bass Lake, northeast of Fresno in the Sierra National Forest, is a popular recreation spot. Think boating, camping, hiking, and off-road vehicles.
Kamuk staging area. It's an OHV staging area for Miami Trails.
So this is a place people come and take their ATVs and their Broncos and stuff?
Yes, sir.
And you're across the advisor number 10.
That's Mark Wilson with the Sierra National Forest. But we're not here to go quadding. We're here to cut down trees with chainsaws. The bark beetle has sucked the life out of so many pine trees along this well-used trail that officials say it's become increasingly unsafe for visitors.
Basically, they're taking them, choking them out, starving them out, and the trees are starting to fade. The top will go red, and next thing you know, you have a standing dead tree, which is a pretty big hazard.
This trail is one of about 50 recreation sites near Bass Lake affected by the bark beetle damage. Dead trees line the base of the lake all the way to the tip of the peaks nearby. Leek Penn is a recreation officer with the Forest Service.
From August till now, in some sites, it's over 100 trees. It's growing to the point where it's faster than we can cut down.
The bark beetles are native to the Sierra Nevada, but have flourished because of the lack of rain and warming temperatures. The beetles burrow into the trees, lay eggs, and when they hatch, the babies eat around the inner layer of bark, cutting off a flow of sap, killing the tree. So many trees have died in the Bass Lake area that the Forest Service has submitted a proposal to the U.S. Forest Service Washington office to cut down trees around popular campsites and trails. Their goal is to protect the public.
We do want to keep these places open. We haven't gone to the point where we've closed sites because of the problem yet. That's pretty much, you know, our last resort.
Penn hopes crews can work throughout the winter cutting down dead trees. She says by next spring, the Bass Lake area may be very bald.
We're biting the bullet because we've already gone into October. We've only submitted a proposal, and we're looking for support and, you know, funding still to try to implement. A limb alone could do extensive damage.
Forest Service officials say the bark beetle issue won't be solved by the possible heavy rains brought by El Nino. Dave Smith is a silviculturist, someone who looks after trees for the Sierra National Forest. He says it's an epidemic.
We'll continue to have this problem even if we get 2 or 3 years of regular rainfall here because of the amount of bugs that are out there in the woods.
Smith says 50% to 75% of the pine trees below 5,000 feet are already dead or dying. The total cost to remove the trees is unknown, but could be in the millions. He says another problem is they don't know where their logs will go.
There's so many dead trees out there, and the mills are so far away, and they're already full of material from the fires. that we may just have to pile and burn them and then hopefully come back and be able to plant.
Smith says the Forest Service will sell as much timber as they can to decrease the amount burned. The other option is to stack the dead trees in piles and wait for a solution yet to be created. In the coming years, he hopes to reforest the area with pine saplings. Back on the trail, Mark Wilson with the Sierra National Forest is overwhelmed by the task ahead. Currently, there are only a few Forest Service employees on the job.
The only thing that we can really do is try to mitigate the hazards that present themselves. A small number of people can actually get out here and make a difference. I mean, it's on a totally different level now.
For now, Wilson and the few others authorized to fell trees will continue to clear recreation areas. But to get the job done and to keep the public safe when campgrounds reopen in the spring, an army of chainsaw operators is needed. With Valley Public Radio News, I'm Ezra David Romero. This is Valley Edition. For over 150 years, California has collectively embraced an identity as a place where people go to reinvent themselves and to remake society. From the gold rush to the silver screen, from valleys of wheat and oranges to valleys of microprocessors and software, the Golden State story is one of innovation and riches, but also tension over what is lost in the process of creating tomorrow. With a new piece in the New York Times, writer Daniel Duane suggests that California is entering a new age, where the California dream isn't filled with sunny optimism, but a much darker vision, one filled, in his words, with a profound sense of loss. It stirred a lot of conversation when it appeared in the Times late last month, and we hope to spur a little more today as Daniel joins us now on Valley Edition. Daniel, welcome.
Hi there. Thanks for having me.
What prompted you to write this piece? You open up describing a trip to Yosemite and comparing it to the differences in the present day from earlier trips that you took there years ago with your family. Maybe describe that scene for us.
Yeah. So I'm a lifelong Californian from a family that, you know, for whom the Sierra Nevada high country has kind of been our summer sanctuary. And it's still absolutely paradise to me, and if it all turns to a smoky desert, I'll still be going every summer. But there was on a family trip to sort of the Yosemite National Park high country this year, the effects of drought and climate change were just getting awfully hard to deny. That, you know, sort of dried out meadows and absence of wildflowers and vanished glaciers. And then as we drove home, we happened to drive across the whole state pretty much, you know, from almost the Nevada line clear back to where we live in San Francisco on that weekend. A lot of your listeners probably remember that weekend in mid-August when it felt like the whole state was on fire, and, you know, there was so much smoke everywhere you could barely see. And by the time I got back to the Bay Area, you know, and thinking about the effects of climate change that we're seeing here in the our coastal waters, and I had kind of seen the whole cross-section of California ecosystems, and it was feeling awfully, you know, unsettling, and it just got me thinking about how California is sort of relentlessly changing.
And you're writing about more than just the ecosystem itself, right?
That's correct. So, you know, there had been other changes. Basically, as I was sort of driving home, I found myself about to say to my kids, you know, it was sort of the smoke and all that stuff, but also just just how much that drive has changed since I was a little kid with the urbanization and, you know, suburban sprawl and all that. And I realized I was about to sound like my own parents 40 years ago. And that got me thinking to how every generation of Californians, you know, it's like sometime right around middle age, we find ourselves saying to our kids, God, you know, I remember back when I was little and this valley was all farms and now it's all subdivisions or whatever it is. And as a student of California history, I kind of, you know, I found myself thinking, well, God, you know, I think this has actually been going on pretty much since the gold rush, actually. You know, there was easy gold on the ground. There really was easy gold lying around on the creek beds in about 1848. You know, by the late 1850s, all that easy gold was gone and the dream was over unless you were, you know, the next group and so on.
So in this case, given that this is a trend that we see in California history every few generations, it seems, is there anything different this time? Or is this just California reinventing itself for a new generation?
Well, is there something different? I don't know, in the sense that I think there's sort of two faces of this phenomenon. And the phenomenon, I mean, is this peculiar, repetitive birth and death of the California dream. And there's sort of two faces to it. On the one hand, you could say, well, come on, it's just cyclical. The world endlessly changes. And I guess just every Californian goes through this. And, it's just the same as ever. California's still a place of innovation. On the other hand, every generation along the way has been right. that something is lost, even as something new is gained. This place changes dramatically in physical ways. And so there is something different this time in that there is something distinctive this time. There are distinctive qualities to what we've lost, even as clearly there is something being gained in the extraordinary economic prosperity, at least around the area where I live.
And that economic prosperity itself creates other problems. Daniel Duane, in his piece, My Dark California, in the New York Times, writes about the housing affordability crisis. And you quote Kevin Starr, the famed California historian, talking about the last two writers ever to buy a home in San Francisco. Talk about that and how that is something that you've seen really transform the idea of the California dream. For so long, it was the dream to own a home, to build a family in a middle-class lifestyle. That is increasingly becoming very difficult in certain parts of the state, including where you live.
Yes, that's right. So I come from a pretty middle-class family, and when I was a kid, growing up in Berkeley, Berkeley was a town where, a public school teacher could buy a home. I had a neighbor who was a professional jazz musician who made a living by gigging in local clubs. That changed in sort of progressive way over 20 plus years. But I now live in a very, anyone from the outside just sort of looking at would consider a very modest neighborhood in a pretty far flung part of San Francisco. In which property values have risen. And it's nice for me on paper, of course, but they've risen so fast that you can even forget about buying a house in these neighborhoods as a young lawyer or doctor. You're not even in the game as a young lawyer or doctor. What I'm trying to say is that when I was a kid, California was a place where a middle-class lifestyle was really possible in the Bay Area, and we're really seeing that disappearing or threatened, at least.
It strikes me that what you're writing about perhaps is about this California paradox. You mentioned that the California that drew your grandfather west and created much of the state that we know today was built on things like the damming of Hetch Hetchy in Yosemite, the devastation of the Owens Valley at the hands of the L.A. Department of Water and Power. Do you see that paradox there in California's history and also in the present day? Is this the latest chapter in that?
I do, and I included my grandfather in that because I'm implicated in that. That's right. I mean, there is this. There's a real undeniable dark side to the California dream, and there has been. There has been for 150 years, in that each new version of the dream does real damage to prior versions of the dream. We can cite examples of that back to the gold rush. We can cite examples of that, like you mentioned, back to the big water grabs of the early 20th century when, the farmers of the Owens Valley were on their way to building one of the great sort of agricultural regions of the United States, when they lost all their water to the bureaucrats and developers of Los Angeles. And yet, it was the availability of all that water that built up the sort of mid-20th century coastal urban paradise that my dad grew up in and loved so much.
another part of what you're describing, do you think perhaps it's just the final close of the post-war chapter, that mid-century era that was typified by a lot of the big infrastructure projects or the incredible growth that we had in Southern California and the aerospace industry and those sorts of things, essentially the end of the modern era, and now we're in this postmodern era as that generation has passed on, and now we're in a very different world with different values and different attitudes towards things?
Yeah, I think that's a fair way to characterize it, and a really accurate way to characterize it, in that, you know, even as there is this cyclical phenomenon to the California dream that I have been struck by, there are really distinctive trait qualities to different periods. And mid-20th century in California, particularly in Southern California, was a kind of sort of miraculous abundance and prosperity. And so maybe that always had to happen. And maybe we are living in the kind of hangover from that party, but that was a period of abundance for the middle class in particular. That was a period of really democratic, widespread prosperity in the way that our current economic gold rush is not.
We're talking with author Daniel Duane. His piece, "My Dark California Dream," is in the New York Times. How do you think California's reputation outside of the Golden State has fared? Because so much of the California dream is just that, how outsiders view the Golden State. Has that changed in any way in accordance with what you're seeing internally?
You know, in some ways, if anything, I think California's reputation as a place of exciting innovation and possibility is better and bigger than it has ever been. I mean, except maybe during the original gold rush, in that, you know, at least this is the impression I get from, you know, people I work with who live in New York City, for example. You know, there's that, and it's sort of amazing as a, I get the impression, at least from people I work with and communicate with a lot on the East Coast, that there's a sort of, you know, wistful eye from the East Coast looking westward going, wow, it is really happening out there. You know, because at some level, for somebody, it is, right? Miraculous fortunes are being made, and the next version of the modern world is being invented in, you know, office parks and, you know, co-working spaces with ping pong tables all around me.
So jumping off from that, which is also a consistent thread in the California experience nationally, that this idea that California is somewhat ahead of the curve, whether we're talking about technology or politics or social issues, California has been considered to be a harbinger of things to come. If we accept your view that the state is in decline, or in some way this state of transition in a dark or rather dark way, what does that mean for the rest of the country as a whole along those lines?
Well, I mean, I guess I'm not really sure. I think the state is in decline. I mean, it clearly is in decline in environmental terms. And, you know, but in economic terms, you know, I don't know. It's not in decline if you're in the tech industry, although it is certainly if you're in other parts of the economy. But the what does it mean? I guess it's just maybe the way to say it is that California life is so... So much of California culture, from our agricultural economy to our tourism economy to our the pleasures that we all enjoy in our beautiful public lands, depends on the health of our natural environment, much more so, I think, than in many parts of the country. It may be true in the Rocky Mountain states, but certainly in the urban, in the sort of urban mid-Atlantic states, you know, it's not so true. So that the sort of environmental unraveling that we are seeing here, I think, produces a much more profound sense of anxiety and alarm than it might in other parts of the country. So maybe in that sense we're the canary in the coal mine.
Do you fear that the next generation, let's say 40 years from now, might write a similar story of California's future and its natural environment and in their time as well?
I think it's virtually guaranteed. Yeah, absolutely. I mean, you know, in the sense that this dynamic in California of, you know, this dynamic of economic reinvention, innovation and renewal and cultural innovation is still so powerfully alive and still drawing so many new people to the state that it is virtually guaranteed that anybody who's arriving here now in their 20s or growing up here now as a little kid in any part of California is going to hit the age I am now, which is not so old, you know, coming up on 50, and look around and say, my God, I remember when I was a kid, you know.
We've been talking with author Daniel Duane. He is the writer of a new opinion piece in the New York Times called My Dark California Dream, talking about what is lost in California's push to invent tomorrow. Daniel is an author of 7 books, and his work appears in Men's Journal, the New York Times Magazine, Food and Wine, and Bon Appetit. He joins us today from his home in San Francisco. Daniel, thank you so much for taking the time to talk with us.
Thanks for having me. It was a pleasure.
This is Valley Edition. Stay with us. Coming up in the next segment, we'll talk about a sustainable look at the world of fashion with Trashik coming to the Fresno Art Museum this weekend. That's coming up in the next segment here on Valley Edition. This is Valley Edition. I'm Joe Moore. The Fresno Art Museum is known for featuring works by top artists, live events, and more. But this Saturday, you can add recycling to that list. It's the 2015 edition of the high-powered fashion show known for turning one person's trash into another person's haute couture. It's called Trashik, and Michelle Ellis-Pracy joins us now to tell us more. Michelle, welcome to Valley Edition.
Thank you so much for having me this morning.
Trashik is back this year after taking a year off. What makes this event so unique and important to the museum?
It's not only unique and important to the museum, but also to the community, because we outreach to artists who are working artists in Fresno. They can be all ages. They can be not an artist as a profession, but as something they do on the side. And we invite them to create garments out of materials that are recyclable materials or actual trash.
So who actually designs these works, and how do you select the artists?
We've selected the artists this year by invitation. So the artists that have participated in the 2010, 11, and 13 Trashiks were invited back again for 2015 because this was my first year doing the event. And basically we give them 12 artists who are either deceased and historic or contemporary and living to be inspired by. So the artist is totally in control of which artist they choose to work from and the garment that they choose to make.
The other thing that I think is interesting here is these are artists that usually work in different mediums than fashion and recycled materials. That has to be a challenge for some of them, but I imagine they're excited by that challenge.
They love that challenge because even if they work in two dimensions, as in an art painter or a mosaic artist, even sculptors are working in a third dimension that is malleable, and they're using materials they wouldn't typically use in their artworks on a regular basis.
So speaking of those materials, where do they come from? Where do they get these things?
Well, actually, if they come up with their idea for the design, for instance, one woman was inspired by Toulouse-Lautrec as her artist, and he was a painter, an impressionist painter who painted the Paris bar scene in the 1860s era, and she went to a local bakery who is known for baking French bread, and she made her costumes out of unused French bread wrappers. So she fashioned these beautiful skirts for the can-can dancers out of these used materials, or unused but recyclable materials.
So how long have they been working on these? What's the process been like in putting this show together and giving the artists their assignments and those sorts of things?
Well, this year we started in August, which was great because it gave them at least 5 months to work. And as the day of the fashion show comes closer, everything is escalated. But all of the costumes are in the building. They're behind a locked door. They will not be debuted by anybody. Nobody can even peek at them until the actual night of the event.
So these are truly one-offs. It's not based on something that someone else did before or another designer or anything like that.
They're one of a kind. And the workmanship this year is exquisite. It's incredible. The thought that has gone into these garments is well-rounded and complete, and I think it's because they had this extra time.
So give us an idea of the event itself. You obviously have the runway and the models going up and down, showing off these works. What else is involved with Trash Chic?
Well, this year we decided to up the ante a bit, and we have a VIP ticket that includes a sit-down dinner in advance of the fashion show, and that's never been part of Trash Chic before. It's just been the fashion show. So the VIP people come about 6 o'clock. They're seated in our sculpture garden under twinkle lights. They're served dinner by the Village Press, and then they go into the fashion show and have VIP seating along the runway. Then for the $85 ticket, that is the fashion show itself and the after party. And then at 10 o'clock, we open the doors for $20 a person, and they can come to the after party. The models are still mingling with the garments on their bodies. The artists are available to ask questions of. So it's really a three-part evening, and we want all of Fresno to feel welcome at this event.
So what happens with the fashions after the show?
This year, for the first time, we are offering them for sale. So as the fashion show ends, the models will line up on the runway with a price tag dangling from their wrist. And as far as I know, they are starting at about $300 and topping off at about $7. And these can be purchased either as wearable art, if you're the right size, because they've been made to fit the model, or sculpture that you might place in your home on an armature of some sort, which we can advise upon. And the artists see 70% of the price. They do all of this free of charge. They get all the materials, all of their time, all of their effort is a gift to the museum.
This also has to be interesting for the people involved, the artists, not only working in a different medium like we talked about before, but also looking at the work of another artist and channeling that in some respect. Talk about that. Do some take a more literal approach to that in really trying to mimic the work of a particular artist, or are there some that are more maybe perhaps loosely inspired or have their own take on another artist's work?
Well, this year the 12 artists include architects and painters and sculptors. So most of the artists look at that person's work. It's a lesson in art history. And then they take whatever they love about that artist and make it three-dimensional. So they're not literally translating, let's say, a Gauguin painting will not be painted onto a dress, but they will create a Gauguin setting or feeling on their garment and take elements of his artwork and put it on their garment, but not do a Gauguin that looks like a Gauguin.
So as we're talking about Trash Chic coming up this weekend at the museum, what else is on the horizon for your organization as we move forward into the remainder of this year and 2016 is right around the corner?
It is. Well, we're gearing up for our holiday party. It's our second annual holiday party. Last year was the first one. And we really do celebrate the art museum as the only art museum in Fresno for our city. And we invite the general public to buy tickets, and that's December 4th. And then we're very excited that in January of 2016, we're bringing in a major exhibition of portraits of Frida Kahlo by one of her lovers, Nicholas Murray. And those portraits will fill two galleries. And we're bringing in an unknown, virtually unknown Fresno artist for one of the spaces. We're bringing in Sonia Romero from Los Angeles. So it's going to be a very powerful season that opens on January 22nd.
If people want more information about Trash Chic or any of the things at the Art Museum, what should they do?
Go to our website, www.fresnoartmuseum.org. Under events, you'll read about Trash Chic. Under future exhibitions, you'll read about Frida Kahlo. And also, you'll read about our holiday party.
Michelle Ellis-Pracy, Executive Director of the Fresno Art Museum, thank you so much for joining us today.
Thank you very much, too.
This is Valley Edition. Our relationship with water is likely to change in the drier, hotter, and more populated California of 2040. This morning, we look at the issue of water rights. Who can use water and how much? A lot of California's arcane system of water rights stretches back to the Gold Rush. Basically, people who claimed water first had access to a source and the right to use it. But can a 19th century approach to water allocation survive in the 21st century? In a special Southern California Public Radio series called The Future of Water, reporter Molly Peterson takes a look.
Author Paolo Bajacalupi offers us one vision of the future of water rights.
The choppers spread out, picking likely targets as they came into range. Showtime.
In his awesome new book, The Water Knife, Bajakalupi imagines a desert Southwest so low on water that cities use helicopters and weapons to enforce their water rights.
Missiles spat from the chopper's tubes, arcs of fire, silent in the air, and then explosively loud as they buried themselves in the guts of Carver City's water infrastructure.
Whoa. Is it really going to come to that? We already fight pretty hard over water rights in California, though at least for now, just with lawyers. Who gets water here is way complicated, so it's worth explaining how it got that way. We'll start in Sacramento, in the state's Water Rights Records Room.
You know, every agency has their treasure trove. This is ours.
Water Rights Enforcement Manager Kathy Marocca and staffer Matthew Jay are taking me to the earliest records of who claims what.
Hey, Matt, come on.
I don't have the combo.
I'm all warmed up.
In the California of 160 years ago, you could make water yours by nailing a note to a tree and just taking what you wanted. Today, that's considered a senior water right. It's a seniority system, so the earliest claims get first dibs on water. Thousands stayed claims like this until 1914, when the state decided it needed more control. It started granting permits for water use, creating junior water rights holders. Those old permits now live in a special fireproof safe.
There we go. Let's see. This was issued July 3rd, 1919.
They've got golden seals and real ink signatures and
all sorts of small print. This license is granted.
The difference between junior and senior are pretty much academic until a drought hits. Then juniors must give up their rights to water in favor of seniors. This pecking order has led to its fair share of legal brawls over the years, and this year has been particularly contentious. For only the second time ever, the state has cut back all junior rights in the Sacramento-San Joaquin Delta, the state's water hub, and moved to limit senior rights. That's causing problems for the San Joaquin Valley town of Mountain House. On a recent day, kids play on a splash pad fed by recycled water. 20 years ago, developers decided to turn acres of farmland into a planned community of single-family homes. For water, they contracted with an agricultural district with very senior rights.
They felt that they were making the right decision at that time.
Ed Pattison manages water for Mountain House. That irrigation district with the senior rights? Earlier this year, the state ordered it to stop taking water from the Delta. The district sued, but it also shut down its pumps. Pattison had to scramble to replace the lost water on the open market, paying more than double what he used to.
I can't say that we even have the budget for it.
Mountain House is only a quarter built and continues to add $500,000 homes. In many ways, Mountain House is California. The state needs water for growth, but projections for stressed water supplies in the future probably mean more fighting.
These issues are usually settled in courtrooms and in hearing rooms with a pile of lawyers instead of with, you know, Black Hawk helicopters and, you know, explosives and that sort of thing.
Tom Howard is the executive director of the State Water Resources Control Board.
I have to believe that's probably what's going, the future is going to continue to look like.
A big reason why is the state's constitution. It says water use has to be reasonable. Brian Gray is an emeritus law professor at UC Hastings.
And reasonable means reasonable in light of the available water, reasonable in light of competing demands for the water, reasonable in light of the effects that diverting and using the water may have on the natural environment.
But if this year is any indication, more frequent droughts in the future are likely to be boom times for lawyers fighting over what's reasonable. Gray and others believe California could turn the heat down on the water wars if rights holders could buy, sell, and move water around more easily. Something similar happened in Australia, says Alex Marshall, and for a similar reason.
Yeah, in a word, drought.
Marshall is with a water trading company that took off during Australia's 14-year millennium drought, when the government reformed its laws to enable a wide-ranging water market. For one thing, it established real-time tracking of water, so it knows how much it can trade.
Having a market that everybody has access to, no matter how much money or how much land they have, means that there is an equilibrium that's naturally found within the market.
California's a long way from Australia's model. For one thing, we'd have to revamp the current water rights system. But a glimpse into California's future might be found in Palo Verde Irrigation District, about 4 hours east of L.A. along the Colorado River. Farmers here have some of the most senior water rights in California, but they're letting about a third of their water flow right by. They've sold it to Urban Southern California's water wholesaler, known as MET for short. Bart Fisher has farmed here his whole life.
And so it kind of makes sense that MET would be drawn to us like a magnet.
Fisher says the deal acknowledges a hard reality, that California cities have power, money, and need in dry times.
So it's really incumbent upon us to be as cooperative as we can to secure our own future.
A future that might just see a lot more water peace. I'm Molly Peterson.
This is Valley Edition. Regular listeners to Morning Edition on FM 89 are familiar with the concept behind the segment StoryCorps. The organization records thousands of conversations between family members and loved ones every year. We often get to share some of the best ones with you, our listeners, on the NPR program Morning Edition. Now through the organization's StoryCorps Legacy Initiative, StoryCorps is branching out and working with hospice organizations all across the country, including here in the Valley, to bring more of those stories to life. Now, in honor of Hospice Month, we have with us in our studio Lauren Nickerson to tell us a little more about the local involvement with StoryCorps. Lauren, welcome.
Thank you so much for having me.
And also on the phone, we have with us from StoryCorps, Perry Chinalai. Perry, welcome to the program.
Thanks so much for having me. It's a real honor.
I want to first start with you, Lauren. How long has your group been involved with StoryCorps here in the San Joaquin Valley and your individuals?
Well, Heinz Hospice has had a partnership with StoryCorps since 2010, and we've been a part of the StoryCorps Legacy Program since 2012. So we have a very long-standing history and relationship with StoryCorps.
And also turning to Perry now, how long has StoryCorps been working with hospice entities?
Heinz Hospice was actually one of our first partner organizations within StoryCorps Legacy. As you know, or as you introduced, StoryCorps is a 12-year-old program, but we launched a program specifically to reach out to people affected by serious illness. So within Legacy, we work with hospitals, hospices, cancer centers, nursing residences, and palliative care programs. So Heinz was really an incredible organization for us to begin this project with, and, you know, together we've just worked so beautifully, and I think really our missions are just so aligned.
Lauren, exactly what is the involvement? What are you doing? What are you doing with StoryCorps and the people who you serve?
Well, basically, StoryCorps allows us to provide recording equipment, and it kind of provides the template to start a conversation. And so we are really able to offer our patients and their families a chance to have meaningful conversations when they're facing terminal illness, which, as you can imagine, for a hospice family and those that they love, those conversations become increasingly important. And it's been a beautiful partnership because through StoryCorps, we're not only able to provide that opportunity for them to start that conversation and have it, but also really archive that conversation and keep it and allow it, the family to use it later.
Now, we have one of those conversations ready to play. This is a story about Maria Rivas. She shares stories about caring for her mother, Julia Medina, during the last 6 years of Julia's life. Maria is in conversation with Heinz Hospice social worker Caroline Dizon.
She was strong. I remember once when the principal of the school, the junior high, kicked me out because I was chewing gum. Mm-hmm. So my mom went up to the school and said, I need to talk to the vice principal. The guy put his fingers in his ears because he didn't want to listen to my mom. And my mom just reached across that desk. I remember she pulled his hands out and she was, you're going to listen to me. Mm-hmm. My daughter was just chewing gum. She's a good student. She wasn't hurting nobody. She wasn't doing anything. I thought she was going to whack him. And that guy looked at my mom, and he apologized to her and said that Maria can go back to class now. And my mom stood there with her arms crossed, and I was so proud of her. I go, man, she's strong.
That's mom.
Yeah, that's mom. Yeah. She was real soft, and I used to love to always touch her skin. I was kind of a pest, I guess. She told me that. She said since I was little, I would sit right next to her and just poke her eyes. And I would grab her cheek and I would pull her skin up like a tent, you know.
Yeah.
And she would go, "Ay, stop it, mija." As she got older, you know, she couldn't move her body as much. So after I bathed her, I put the lotion on her. She would tell me, "Oh, that feels so good. It's good." And it was so rewarding. I really, really, really miss that. I used to work in Yosemite. And whenever I'd come for the weekend, when I would leave, my mom would step out on the porch and she'd wave. I knew that one day she wasn't going to be out there to wave at me. So I would go back to Yosemite and I'm driving and I'm crying for miles and miles. I'm thinking about her waving. So I said, one day I need to take a picture of her waving. Now, we have a big picture of her that's by her couch that she sit on. And I'm so, so happy I took this picture because before I leave for class or before I go to work, I always open the door back up and I go, "Bye, Mom," and I wave at her, wave at her picture. I miss her waving goodbye, and yeah, I miss that.
That was Maria Rivas sharing a story about caring for her mother, Julia Medina, during the last 6 years of Julia's life, recorded in the Heinz Hospice here in Central California in partnership with StoryCorps Legacy. We're talking with StoryCorps Legacy Associate Director Perry Chinalai and Laura Nickerson from Heinz Hospice in Fresno with us in our studio. Perry, tell me what your organization does to train the individuals who are involved with this. Is there an art to facilitating a conversation, especially around end-of-life issues like this or this at that sort of time?
Sure. So when we work with a partner organization, we actually train their staff and volunteers to go out into the community, really to the places where people are being served, to conduct these conversations and record them. So the training itself is a 4-day training, and because we've worked with Heinz for so long, we've actually conducted 2 of these with staff and volunteers. And the first day is really about an overview, the benefits of this type of reminiscence program for people affected by serious illness. It's really talking about the model, you know, which is 2 people who know each other. And so we talk all about kind of the culture of the organization and how we can make this project really work there. The second day we go over equipment and paperwork because, as you know, we use really high quality equipment. We want to provide the best possible CDs to participants. And then the 3rd and 4th day, we're actually shadowing the first few interviews that have been taking place. Throughout our relationship with Heinz, we've been in frequent conversation about, you know, kind of supporting and nurturing this partnership as we go along and providing this opportunity to as many people in the Valley as we possibly can.
Turning to Lauren now, what has the experience been like for your staff members and watching these conversations take place and being there? I imagine there's a lot of very touching moments, even regardless, outside of the StoryCorps program. But has it changed things in any way, having the opportunity for family members and other loved ones to sit down in front of a microphone and talk about these things, sharing it with another loved one or, in this case, a staff member?
Absolutely. I mean, the experience has been profound. And it has been profound not only for our patients and our families, but as you mentioned, our staff as well. And it's so interesting to see staff members who haven't yet had an opportunity to experience a StoryCorps interview go out and actually go on one and help facilitate one. And they come back and they say, "This is the best thing we can offer our patients and families." Not only does it align with our mission of providing support for our patients and their loved ones, but it also aligns with our mission of, really caring for someone at the end of their life. And our staff can see that firsthand when they really start that StoryCorps conversation and they really help facilitate those really meaningful relationships.
Perry, I think a lot of our listeners are very familiar with StoryCorps, at least in experiencing it on the air. They might not know the story of the organization as an entity. Give us a little insight into how StoryCorps came about with your founder, David Issay, and staff, and how the idea was developed.
Sure. So the idea, as I mentioned earlier, was developed about 12 years ago. And it was really with the idea that, this is a project that can foster bonds, that can bring people together. And so Dave really started this. He's a radio documentarian who just found that people can connect so deeply if they have an uninterrupted, often intimate encounter with somebody that they know, and kind of a dedicated space to have that conversation. So he was really motivated to begin this project, and I think that we can all relate to this idea of preserving the stories and the history of our families, so that we can also share that with generations down the line.
We have another local segment in the StoryCorps Legacy Partnership with the Heinz Hospice now. This is a story from Linda Johnson and her daughter, Brandy Snyder, talking about their family's experiences with breast cancer and the impact of their grandchildren on their lives.
Brandy Snyder.
My name is Linda Johnson. I'm her mother.
So then we have our next little friend that came into our family, Miss Harley.
Miss
my brother's first daughter.
Miss Harley, she's quite the little girl herself, very independent. She was born March 12, 1999, and then February of 2000, I was diagnosed with breast cancer. So she became what gave me the will to really fight.
In March of 2013, I was diagnosed with breast cancer. God had sent Harley to you.
And God sent Jackson to you.
Yes, he did. My little grandson.
Yeah. Well, you were diagnosed
9 days after he was born.
9 days after he was born.
I was sitting at the hospital,
right,
looking at my grandson for the first time, and I didn't know, basically 2 months to the day, I would be back in that same hospital having both of my breasts removed.
That was something that I didn't want you to experience, but
it happened.
It happened, and you handled it really good. We've been through quite a bit, but I always say I'm a survivor celebrating life.
Definitely. I feel like I had the drive and I had the passion and I had the will to live because I had seen you drive to radiation by yourself and come back home for 38 treatments, when Dad was working. And
right,
we wanted to be there for you, but you were like, no, I got this.
You know, when he had to go back to work, I just said, hey, I'll do it myself. Me and my little blue blazer, we would go from Porterville to Visalia, twice a week, and then during the 38 days of radiation. Some days were rough, some days were hard, but hey, we made it.
We made it,
yeah.
You're definitely a strong woman.
Well, thank you. We're not only mother and daughter, we're best friends. So.
Yes.
Love you.
Love you too.
Linda Johnson and her daughter Brandy Snyder talking in Fresno about the experiences they shared dealing with breast cancer as part of the partnership between Heinz Hospice and StoryCorps Legacy. We're talking about that today on Valley Edition. This partnership goes back several years now, and it's also Hospice Awareness Month. Turning to our studio guest, Lauren Nickerson now, can you tell us a little more about what your mission is in terms of serving the Valley's population dealing with these end-of-life issues?
So Heinz Hospice serves Fresno, Madera, and Merced County, and we provide hospice care to people facing the end of their life. And we also provide bereavement support for their loved ones and their families. And we also have a Center for Grief and Healing that is open to the community. And so, our goal and our mission as Heinz Hospice is to provide expert hospice care to our patients and love and support and honoring their journey as they face the end of their life.
These
stories as part of StoryCorps. Is there a reluctance by some people to participate in it, or what has the overall response been like from the people you serve?
You know, that's an interesting question. I would say that occasionally they do give some reluctance, and really it's about their insecurities about not having a story to share. And we always remind them, you know, you don't necessarily have to have a specific story, because this is about having a conversation and starting a meaningful conversation. And, you know, what is always so funny is that when they start those conversations with their loved ones or a volunteer or facilitator through Hines, they just start talking. And it's amazing how quickly those 40 minutes can really go, and how everyone does, in fact, have a story. And not only do they have a story, but it's a meaningful one, and it's important to hear.
Turning now to Perry Chinnalai, who's with StoryCorps Legacy, I imagine that these stories are also very important after that loved one has passed away, and people can revisit those recordings. Sometimes just hearing the sound of a loved one's voice brings back so many powerful memories and emotions. Is that a common thread that you've seen?
Absolutely, absolutely. In some cases, we've had to rush CDs to participants, you know, family members, if they have passed away. These CDs have been played in memorial services. They've been distributed to many family members. Sometimes we've actually had to burn two CDs because the first kind of was so played out. It's an opportunity for families to come together and listen to their loved one's story and remember that person. We've also seen that organizations really appreciate hearing these stories and getting to know their community members in this way. I mean, it's a 40-minute conversation about what the participants' values, preferences, priorities, passions are all about, and it's really about the family story.
Now, the other thing that I think is maybe appropriate for this conversation is you don't have to be in an end-of-life situation to take the time to do this. You don't have to participate in StoryCorps as well. You also provide recommendations for people who want to maybe document their own stories. Is that not correct, or at least advice?
Yes, absolutely. If you go to the StoryCorps.org website, you'll actually find some do-it-yourself resources. And StoryCorps recently released an app that you can download on your smartphone that would also allow people to record conversations that way as well.
Great, and that's available on the App Store on most platforms there?
Most platforms, and also on the StoryCorps.me website.
Great. We'll look for that, and also look to hear more of these on our air, as Valley Public Radio is excited to share some more of these local stories from the partnership with Hines Hospice, based in Fresno, and StoryCorps Legacy. Our guest today on the phone is Perry Chinnalai with StoryCorps Legacy, and Lauren Nickerson in our studio, the fund development coordinator at Hines Hospice. Thank you both so much for joining us today. That's all for today's Valley Edition. Like to know what you think. You can send us your comments. You can email us talk@kvpr.org or send us a tweet. We are @KVPR and @Valley Edition. For Valley Edition producer and reporter Ezra David Romero, reporter Deanna Aguilera, and reporter Jeffrey Hess, audio engineer Marv Allen, and production and operations manager Don Weaver, I'm Joe Moore. This is Valley Edition on Valley Public Radio.
Support for Valley Edition comes from the James Irvine Foundation, the California Endowment. Health happens when California values schools more than prisons. Learn more at calendow.org. And the California Healthcare Foundation, rating hospitals, doctors, and long-term care. Smarter choices start at calqualitycare.org.